Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the AES June lecture. A few faces here I don't recognise, so welcome. I think most of you are aware of what the AES is and what it does, so I won't elaborate too much on that. My name is Bill Foster. I'm now past chair of the Society in the UK, having been chair last year, and standing in tonight for Will Evans, our chairman, who unfortunately couldn't be here this evening. So we have a topic for tonight of audio over IP. Yes, we've had audio over cable originally, bits of wire, and then we had audio over ISDN, which a couple of us were talking about earlier on. Now it's everything's gone IP, of course, so audio naturally has to follow suit. Not always trouble-free. So we've asked a gentleman who has had quite a bit of experience in battling with internet protocols to come and talk to us about it. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Weitzel, who I'm sure many of you know, many years with the BBC, and then with when the BBC sold off its ground... reorganised.
The guy ran out of money, so he had to sell something.
Moved to Siemens and is now has his own consultancy, Weitzel TV. So, as I say, I don't think I need to give Peter a long introduction. You'll know him very well. Peter, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Bill.
OK. Perhaps a bit of the motivation behind why I felt this was good. There was a great deal of need to share knowledge. The systems that I've been working on go back 10 years, and I'll be mentioning one which is in the second generation. We need to get people out and understand, and a lot of what I'm going to be talking about today is sort of techniques and ideas that will stop you making the mistakes that we made. Some of them were a bit silly, some of them were because actually we were working with technology that was sort of being developed almost before, well, hopefully just before we got it installed. Sometimes it's a little bit later. Just to look at what the team, and actually talk a little bit about how getting the right people there and the broadcasting experts will hold it together, and then perhaps be a little bit whimsical. I'm not as good at that as John Emmett is, but I did think, July, nice hot weather, glass of dry white wine. But let's move on. Basically, in terms of sort of connectivity using IP, local area network, nice, it sort of lives within the building. The internet, not very nice, it goes everywhere. And in the middle, there's a wide area network, which is sort of managed version, and that's really what we're going to be looking at. You've got technologies like Livewire and Ravenna, and over the internet, the ASIP protocols. WAN has got no sapping name, so I have got this audio and actually video over IP. A lot of what goes here for audio works with video, and a lot of what happens with video gives us some ideas for audio. But actually, I'm going to be looking a little bit wider than that in all of this. So, I'm going to be talking about what we're trying to achieve by all of this, look at two working systems, introduce three rules, then the team was a bit more than four, so the thing sort of breaks down. The success and failures, this is a lot of the sort of meat of how you need to think about things. Look at some IP features. I am not somebody that understands IP totally. I've got people, some of whom are in the audience, who are my IP specialists. So when it comes to the end of point seven, they can help me out there. But actually to do some summing up of where things are, and just to show you that it's all happening. So what are we trying to achieve? Well, it's quite simple. We're trying to get sound from one place to another. It used to be quite simple. We used to have a wire, and that sort of worked quite well. When the wire got a bit long, we put an amplifier in. Quite simple. Of course, along came John Nunn and co. and said, we want to digitise it. Let's make it AES3. And then, OK, well, to get it farther, you need a telco involved. So you might do something like this. A little bit of buffering, but it all runs nicely synchronously. Of course, Chris Chambers comes along, AS47, let's packetise it, put it over a packet network, works quite elegantly. Notice that some clocks there, which we'll touch on later. And of course, because of that, you need to synchronise to get good AES throughout the far end. And of course, then you don't have enough bits on the WAN, therefore you want to compress, and therefore you've got it getting more complicated, isn't it? And then you go and put it over IP. So you've got your audio over IP, a few other audios over IP. Then all these people come along with all sorts of other things that they want to put over that cloud. And it all gets a bit complicated, doesn't it? And that's really what we're trying to achieve. So, okay, why IP? Well, it's quite simple. It's cheap. The accountants have heard about it. It's there all the time. But of course, why not? It is non-deterministic, it's lossy, it has latency, it's a very strange place to be, and in any case, the IT department own it. But actually, there are some benefits, and for audio over IP, the bitrate might come free of charge. Therefore, the wide area network might have enough bits in it for you not to have to compress too tightly, get better quality audio. Funny things called SNMP and other things enable you to remotely monitor equipment so that you know how it's easier to operate. And actually operating all of this stuff is key to what we're talking about. Also, this funny cloud type stuff. Incidentally, IT people draw clouds because they haven't the foggiest idea what's in them. They all appear nice and soft and cuddly, but remember that. But these different architectures can actually give intrinsic resilience, which is quite interesting. Perhaps not quite in the way the IT people think about it, and you might be able to route. We'll talk about that later. Key disclaimer there. And that's the next sentence. So, let's start off with the first sort of example. National Public Radio in the States. Back in 2002, they run quite an interesting business. They distribute to 1,000 sites by satellite, either live streams, and which could be genuine live streams, or they could be sending it from a recorder over the air as a stream to another recorder at the far side. Let's see if this thing works. Oh yes, so they can run it from a recorder to there, or if the worst comes to the worst, and a lot of it, you just send a man and put it there. Now, if what you're doing is sort of shunting magazine programs around, that, you know, yes, it's sort of sneaker net, except it's done by the US Postal Service, who happen to go out to Hawaii, very nice place to go out to Hawaii, or up to Alaska, which is not so nice to go up to. So that's what they had got. And what they were looking for was to say, okay, files are coming in. So can we replace the tape with files? So how do we shunt the files over? And actually getting even better than that, because places like Amazon were just coming on stream, these stations could order up what they would like to be sent to them. So it's all web interface, which just about runs on the dial-up from Alaska and from various places in the Midwest. Bung it all out over the satellite as files, dropping it onto boxes. Files, obviously IP. Well, actually, I could point out that it doesn't have to be IP, but it sort of fits in quite nicely that way. So, okay, we're now going to change our satellite to become an IP pipe. How the hell do we get audio over it? So they came and talked to us in BBC Technology about both the idea of dropping files in and that media management system, and also what their pressing need was to get live programming out. We did actually point out to them that they didn't need to do it, they could still do it, but they didn't fully, being American, they didn't understand DVB, which is one thing we had to educate them on. But they also quite liked what we understood about electronic program guides. and other bits and pieces, because again, scheduling, all of these sorts of things, even for files, needed to be done. So in a mad panic, immediately before 1IBC, we hijacked a large quantity of equipment that was going from Rennes to Amsterdam, but it happened to come via London, to demonstrate to them actually doing audio over IP, over satellite, and back down again, which was quite convenient. I mean, if you're working in a place that's got 14 dishes parked out the back. The ASI stream was being carried over IP as well. So we had DVB over IP, as well as audio in DVB, etc. So massive amount of encapsulation. Much education went on about the sort of issues and the sort of tests and what the issues were that people should be looking for, which weren't necessarily what they felt that they should be looking at. Unfortunately, we couldn't get them away from using MPEG-1 layer 2 coding, which is a bit of a pity. So that's what it now looks like. Sort of clouds, servers, that sort of thing. To take one of their drawings, they don't really see the difference between a stream and a file now. It is all what you order up. Some boxes there, which this is now the second generation product. They're just rolling this out after we had put in a system in 2003-2004. That's now being replaced by those boxes, which are basically L band in, IP out. And a lot of stations are now using live wire to connect to their desks. Right, let's talk about BBC. BBC sort of has a connectivity which can be, in London, it's typically dark fibre between buildings, therefore MADI or ASI, OAS3. Their main sites are connected by the so-called Raman network, which is duplicated STM64s, which carries audio as, well, decent audio over ATM as AS47, but there are a right assortment of things, including, and don't forget it, the all UK radio feeds being carried on an E1 as an ICAM. But there's a right variety. What we were looking at was typically the UK non-main sites. So English region local radio stations, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, and perhaps one or two other odd bits and pieces in the meantime. And we moved them to IP, carrying Abtext coded 20-bit, 48 kilohertz sampled audio, i.e. as near perfect as you get in a studio centre. With those parameters, which basically put about a 30 millisecond latency from audio in to audio out. I'll just mention the World Service is increasingly using audio over IP, using MPLS circuits, either EABTEX or MPEG, at lower bit rates, I have to say. Why do it? It's cheap. The vast cost saving of the circuits, because you started off with fractional E1s, three off, and you can put all of that lot in a 10 meg circuit. Now, you've probably got, I don't know, let's say 3 megabits per second on the E1s. Go over to a 10 meg pipe, you've got at least another 3 megabits per second to play with. So us running 600-700 megabits per second, kilobits per second, is almost trivial in that thing. That's one of the things about IP. And it certainly was a considerable cost saving. So, for the nations and non-local radio in England, we in Siemens led that work, where we picked up a set of requirements. Scotland has about 14 sites that had AVID and VCS in those sites, so it wasn't sort of nice, empty networks, you've got people editing large files, which they tried to put down too thin pipes, so they didn't quite hit the news headlines. Therefore, a few 100 meg circuits in, but about 60 audio codecs, with sort of hub sites in, it's Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, and Inverness. Wales, which actually happened later, but we did the design around the same sort of time, six sites, different network here actually. Scotland was hub and spoke, sort of homed onto Glasgow and the two northern sites. Wales, it was cheaper to go in sort of a number of chains, even if in reality those chains, which usually had a cable and wireless circuit in and a BT circuit out, all BT circuits go through Birmingham. That was the way in which it worked. And Northern Ireland is nice and small. You can drive around all sites in a day. We also did some odd bits of audio over IP, like in London from Richmix in the East End, or circuits out to Caversham. And cable and wireless under the contract Siemens had did a like-for-like replacement for local radio, which is very much more like this 10-meg replacement that I showed. 36 local radio stations, each home to its regional centre. So somewhere like Birmingham has six local radio stations into it. A lot of that was on RS1000Ds, which are a Redcare product for closed-circuit television. But you can buy them with a 100-meg circuit alongside. Not the world's best 100-meg circuit, and there are a few little things, like if somebody digs it up, they don't sort of guarantee to fix it particularly rapidly. But it's a very, very cost-effective way of getting a 100-meg circuit. And as well as that, we added video for BBC Alibaba, some JPEG 2000 codecs, and on some of the more dodgy circuits, a low bitrate H.264, again, a low latency coder. Wales, actually all the circuits were good enough to run JPEG 2000 at about 20 megabits per second. So the circuits to and from Bangor, and we then added those, some of which I'm certain will be used, have been used at the weekend, because one of the issues that they had was they couldn't get video out of a number of places like Aberystwyth. The like. In theory they could, but the actual vision circuit used to be on the back of the analogue television distribution. So if it started off at Mould, which is a site that they had to have because it had a dish on the roof going into Blanplui, if we said, OK, well, actually you want to broadcast from Wrexham, we've got a video circuit, they sold the building at Mould and made enough money out of to go and fund most of this lot. Except it was in somebody else's budget, but you know, that's the sort of cost savings that we were getting. A bit boring, some blue boxes, some black and cream boxes, and some black boxes. The kit that was used for audio, we did evaluation and chose the APTX, the APT Oslo, and the Horizon. We use those on the Siemens installations. Cable and wireless just use Oslos at both ends of the circuit. And just for completeness, the TVIPs audio JPEG 2000 coders and some high vision, the low latency H.264. All of these came from some evaluation work that we did. I can't go into too much detail, but you know, it really got somewhat hairy. The most entertaining tale is actually a video codec where we unplugged the video codec, the coder, and saw the picture on the output went to black and everything. And then, you know, sort of after having a cup of coffee or something like that, plugged it back in, and the coder had buffered everything. Since we'd unplugged it. So we thought it didn't have that much memory in it. And we actually sort of took it apart and we just could not see how much that it had enough RAM to go and store this. But that's what it did. And it was very exciting if you had sort of a slight sort of jitter on the IP circuit, because you wouldn't lose anything. It's the sort of thing actually you need if you are in a drone flying over enemy territory. You're trying to live downlink most of the time, but when you lost the link, you wanted to store it. Not exactly how you'd want a broadcast IP codec to work. But we did a lot of work, particularly with the video, before settling on this. Okay. I do have a qualification in theology, so I thought, as it's 400 years since the King James Bible, and unfortunately I couldn't find a suitable, elegant font that the original version had. But I think this actually sums up a lot of what we're doing. In the Old Testament form of what we're talking about, everything was nicely sort of analogue and physical. You know, the least physical thing is this sort of spirit of God moving on the face of the waters. However, New Testament version, you've got all of this sort of peculiar concept about words and God and the identity of the same. And in fact, not good for specification, but that they actually say it twice just so that you really get it. And these are the three rules. Every packet counts. All it needs is just best practice. And it is complex because of interrelationships. Quite how these fit together. But these are all sort of things that you go into an audio over IP experience trying to grasp. So, every packet counts because it's what contains your content. Incidentally, packets do count themselves. This is a bit I did learn. RTP packets have a sequence number and a timestamp, so that you know that they actually count themselves. Very useful for when you're doing diagnosis. And if you lose things, well, yes, you can lose them because the telecom WAN is narrower than the IP circuit you're connecting to it. That's quite interesting. It's a bit like trying to put your hose pipe together. It all sprays out the side and you lose packets. Routers not set up properly. And there's contending traffic, which again causes you problems. So all you need is just best practice to set everything up. Just a few brief mentions. These are a little bit wordy, so I'm going to go through them quite quickly, and we perhaps can pick up any points of question and answer. Best practice, contention. Even if you have my lovely codecs putting a packet out once every 7.1 milliseconds, if they both put a packet out at the same time, that contends, even if you're going into a 1 gig circuit. Remember that. So, can't get round it, you can avoid it by going in at a point where you haven't got too much, straight onto the WAN if you possibly can. You will always need buffers. You've got these packets coming in. It's a good idea to set your packets. The minimum buffer that you can really do is about two packets, ideally three. And that comes in, as we will talk later. So you need to set a consistent network, if at all possible, so all your packets are coming in at roughly the same time, same frequency, and allow for latency. And just think the network might reconfigure. I touch on that towards the end. A quick lemma, watch your clocks, I think is really all I'm saying. There are a number of domains, and you've got this poor decoder, which is taking packets in, which are coming at different times, contain the same amount of data, and actually kept containing the clock that you have got to recover. Now, that's not the same as the clock that is actually flapping up and down at 100 megabits per second on the network. You're actually having to do that. And so ensuring your clocks are reasonably set, and ideally that your sending end has some relationship to the end, to the receiving end, does help a great deal. And there's some interesting things about ensuring your clocks are in the right domain. But this brings you into the thing, but you can get around some of these problems if you make the packets nice and small, so you're forever just kicking the clock every so often. Remember, on encapsulation, you've got to have all the data in before you send the packet out. Larger packets, uses less network bandwidth, as we'll come to, has a longer packetization delay. And, of course, these are the overheads. This is actually taken from an APT publication, which I reference it right at the end. What we're talking about here is that you end up with 66 bytes per packet of overhead. So I've got 520 bytes of audio data, and I bung another 66 bytes on, which takes the data rate up to 650 kilobits per second or thereabouts, but it is still only one packet every 7.1 milliseconds. So I'm taking 700 kilobits per second out of my 10 meg circuit or whatever for this, not just under 600. Which means it's important to monitor what's going on. And most tools are looking at megabits per second. They're looking at flows. They're not looking at packets. And what matters is the near instantaneous packet rate. And you need monitoring to check that your packets are not getting lost, which are missing, they've gone out of sequence, or they've arrived too late to be decoded, which we refer to as missed. And only your decoder can tell you that. So look for that in the decoder and also in the coder to check that, you can directly compare that what's being sent is being received. Which brings us to monitoring. There are a number of things. I've divided it up into a monitoring situation, which is what you're doing all the time, a configuration, which is probably once every so often, and then control, which could be a little bit more frequent than the configuration, but basically is stuff that you might be using actually for diagnostics, so you're actually changing something to see whether that makes any difference. You can see, actually, the chain that we've gone through has been complex because we've been looking at all the relationships, which just proves the third rule, so I won't go on too long about that. I think in the middle of that page is the best example I got of IP addresses. It's a bit like when you're trying to wire your signal across a building. I started full-time at Bush House, and one of my first jobs was to try to get something from one end of Bush House to the other, and therefore you had to sort of get it out of the studio to a particular frame room on that block, work out what your jump ring was onto another block to go on a tie cable, work out the other end, etc., all the way through. If you think of IP addresses like that, you have to work those sorts of things out. That helps a great deal. But of course, you have to do it when actually you've got two boxes and, a wire connecting them on the desk, on the bench. So, yeah. But let's look at some of the fun and games of the real world of interconnections. So you start there, you end there, and that's roughly what the flows do. And actually, you need to monitor it. That's what the box down the bottom is doing. And yet, in the real world, these have interesting interconnects. That's between two buildings that are, well, you can almost wave at each other. Therefore, a LAN extension is put in there. The next bit is a long circuit, so you can't afford a vast... In fact, you can't get... We tried to get 100 meg for that circuit for good reasons, but we only get 20 meg. And then, when it gets more complicated, you go multiple path using various different technologies. And actually, that 20 meg circuit starts off as 20 meg on 100 meg bearer, disappears into the telephone exchange, where it gets messed around into multiple E1s. It then goes over a radio link, which is great fun because in that part of the world it blows quite often. And in fact, the circuit was most unreliable because the dish kept on blowing off and landing and killing sheep. And we had to cope with the telco, who refused to pay the farmer compensation for the sheep. Therefore, he wouldn't let them on their land. We sort of got round that. And then it then goes through a typical telco's infrastructure, which is basically exploiting as much as they can get out of the fibre that they've got in. And then it comes back on what appears to be a very civilised 100 meg connection. Okay. I think this is actually the thing that I miss now most, but I retired. I just don't go. I haven't got the fun of coming into work and hanging around great people. Where do I start with that? And that's not anything like a complete list. Let's start at the bottom right, because if it wasn't for people that I now have to refer to them as either South Lab or North Lab, what I remember as Kingswood, people like Pete Stevens, who's here, and Chris Chambers and Yang Xing, a lot of the fun and games that we had wouldn't happen. They were great at giving us some support and doing things, and also quite good fun when they got a little bit impractical, but we could help them out there. The client, Steve Westlake and Nigel Adams in the BBC, really very, very good at understanding what the technology and actually what the BBC required. Obviously, our partner in Cable and Wireless, getting the circuits up and running, and both TechX, who provided the TVIPS codecs, and Broadcom for the APT audio codecs, both of whom I see here, a great deal of sort of assistance to us in BBCT and Siemens, whether it's on the project side, Dave Soditis, principal project manager running the cable and wireless stuff, or us, typically more on the sort of techie side of the business, myself. Basically, I think I spent sort of over 35 years, doing all the jobs that nobody in the right mind would want to touch, including on one occasion being the BBC's official spokesman on sex and violence in programmes. Peter Cowart-Smith is known for his great love of video quality. Actually, he did get one good thing at the end of the thing. He finally decided that he ought to get married, and he and Lisa are doing very nicely. Chris Harrison, who was our WAN specialist, he's here in the audience, but not just a WAN specialist, he also started his days working on shortwave transmitters, BBC Designs Department, and now he's retired, sits in his hut at the bottom of the garden making things using surface mount components, probably stolen from ultra-efficient lighting fittings that have gone thut. Let's just pick up some of the others. Bob Hanscom was involved right at the beginning with NPR, but his main contribution is getting test scripts made. Richard Vodden, nice chap here, he, like me, plays the trumpet. He's probably the BBC's best IP and accredited to what infinite level with Cisco. But when he joined us, he refused to do anything that wasn't audio. So I got him on video, and we then got him on DVB systems and IP. And then a bunch of so-called youngsters. I mean, Peter, Daniel, and Lyndon are now, 12, 15 years into their careers. But that's quite good. Tim Harrison, who was with us for a short time before he decided that his direction was best served by wandering across the road to South Lab, where he's the one of the BBC's video coding specialists. And the two real youngsters who were characters that we got in from as part of their university course, Andy Clark and James Witham. Andy is now with the BBC, and he can't be with us tonight because he's putting Radio Man in Luton. And James is working for Discovery out at Chiswick, and he's stuffing tapes or doing tests or something or other till 8 o'clock tonight. But actually, it goes back a long time. Chris Stewart in local radio came up with this idea that we could do things. it didn't really get much further than that. Then we had all of these things. There were some others as well, looking at the BBC transmitter contract, the Arqiva one, but actually looking at some interesting connectivity options there. And then other bits and pieces. Streaming previews from Beijing. The BBC had a lot of its staff in the UK watching compressed feeds over IP, doing the logging, so we had to get timecode in as well, and then sort of faxing or emailing back to Beijing to get the items cut from the high-quality material. Oh, the Super Hi-Vision, this is great fun and games. If you want video over IP at 800 megabits per second, with some very, very keen Japanese that would not allow you to lose a single packet, and you've got to get from City Hall to the IBC at the Rye Centre in Amsterdam, dual path all the way. Well, we had a little bit of a problem in Amsterdam. There's about 160 meters where the fibre actually does go in the same duct. But in London, it was on two totally different dark fibre networks. But we also slipped in a bi-directional HD video so that people could, so the presenter, both ends could see what was going on. Just in case the audio failed, we put in a large quantity of channels of quality audio. And we also had, just in case, some talkback as well. Just to, and we sneaked that in, and they didn't notice that we were messing up their lovely pure circuit. And then there were a number of other things, self-operated contribution equipment, VSAT, local radio backhaul, all sorts of things. What made it work? The fact that everybody was doing other things. So that we were, and we've got a number of projects which we're cross-learning from. So I mentioned Steve Westlake's operation. The fact we're working both audio and video, I'm concentrating a bit on audio tonight, obviously, but video had a lot of things. Enthusiastic, yeah. There were some very enthusiastic colleagues. I can remember one who offered BBC, who said, guaranteed to BBC Scotland that we would deliver a negative latency codec, which was very helpful. And we just had the critical mass of work, and people knew how to write it down. When it went wrong, first thing, not remembering the first three rules. I mean, I more or less could have that on my telephone answering machine when people phoned up from the lab. People had a peculiar focus on the hardware. You know, it stopped working. Well, the reason it stopped working was quite simple. The dish fell off and killed a sheep, not the codec failed. And actually understanding that the whole, what is the end-to-end requirements? Let's go back one. And obviously, all the usual things that cause things to go wrong. You don't plan. You don't check what you're doing. You don't tell anybody. Write it down. I put this one in because a lot of stuff didn't get off the ground. There's this idea, it's IP, it's cheap. But when you actually sit down and work out the requirements, it is not just a couple of codecs and a bit of connectivity, which probably comes free. You have got other things around it. Self-operated contribution, just the cost of the microphones horrified people. They just hadn't costed that in. It quite often moves costs elsewhere. Sometimes the costs are deeply reduced and come off your budget. So you go from lots to zero. The problem is you've got to con somebody else into taking a little bit that comes out of their budget. And the cost of transformation was quite, could be a bit of a hindrance. Basically, it only works if everybody cooperates. Now, the BBC, as you well know, is a loose confederation of warring tribes. So sometimes it was quite interesting trying to get some cooperation. Other issue was that, yeah, local pilots sort of worked brilliantly. It required an engineer, both ends, to speak nicely to the equipment to get it to work. Not exactly the way you'd want to offer a managed service. And finally, nobody had any money. We were moving from a situation where you could get 120, well, two, three, four times the functionality for very little extra cost. In fact, on one occasion, we were offered a gigabit per second circuit for the same price as a 10 meg. You needed to do a little bit less for a lot less money. Some of the success factors. We're very good at getting stuff set up in the lab so that you could check out what was going on. People could get around it. People get familiar with it. They could actually see. You know, if what you're thinking of doing is you're controlling a codec which is in Lerwick. Now, those of you who don't know where Lerwick is, next time you look at the weather chart, it is the top right. They always label it. It is 200 miles away from Norway. It is further from Glasgow than London is. And you know, you are having to control that. So the idea that you've got a feel for what the equipment looks like is not a bad idea, and sort of how it might flash its light so you can get somebody up there to have a look. I think the ultimate was Peter Calvert-Smith, who was controlling codecs in Stornoway, video codecs in Stornoway, from a barge on the Thames. But that's what you can do. The basic lab testing, the acceptance or the selection or this sort of thing, or proof of concept testing, document what you're going to do and why you're doing it and what are your expected results. So you've got something to start with. You know, I have this codec here. What am I expecting from it? And if you're doing any sort of development, run your regression tests regularly, because you, I mean, again, a video codec example, you change the bitrate on the industry standard video codec and the lip-sync goes out. You have to readjust that. And also, do listen to what goes on. Don't believe these confounded meters. Listen and watch what's going on. Let's have a think about some of the lab work. This is a lovely one. We got it all working in the lab. We took it to a pilot site. And again, the idea of doing a pilot site, which actually was Luton. And it's all set up. And it glitched like hell. So we thought, aha. Well, are we losing any packets? No, we weren't losing any packets. We put lots of testing on, no packets. So, okay, ship the whole lot back to the lab and find out what's going on. So, the thought was the clocks were not being locked. So we just set up a Lichesu figure. And that was absolutely brilliant. It showed that the clocks were not being locked left, right and centre. And in fact, so much so that we actually use it as a standard commissioning test now, just to check that everything actually is locked up. Because there are all sorts of presets in codecs and what, you can decide what clock you're going to be using and you might have got it wrong. But that was something nice and simple. I understood that. The acceptance test was that there had to be no more than one glitch every 24 hours. Now, is that a parameter on an analog circuit? Is that a parameter on BT Music Line? No, but we had to cope with it. So we had to work out what a glitch was, and actually by listening and looking the waveform, there were different sorts, and Peter Couchsmith had infinite amount of fun defining what a glitch was. But it was not normal audio, and it was very audible. If you use a 1 kHz tone and then sort of filter it out, the resultant is anything that is a glitch. You also were monitoring to see that the 1 kHz tone was actually constant. But basically, you just sort of set that up, and it just sat there, and if anything went wrong, it glitched. A combination of exotic LaCroix sampling scopes and other bits and pieces would actually sort it all out and set off a recorder, so that we got loop recorders so that we could actually listen to what had happened. And it got so good that we really had worked out what a glitch was, and we'd actually directly relate that to packet loss. So we never, after a few glitch tests, you just used a packet loss test rather than a glitch test because we were so certain. Just incidentally, that bit of kit there is a Vistek valid lip sync generator, which we use to measure latency. It makes doing things very nice and easy. Oh yes, this is a lovely one. All I have to say is one of the jobs that we did actually for Lyndon Potter and his new job with the BBC was look at the video equipment going into West Swan. And there's one leading manufacturer's video distribution amplifier that fails that test. If you unplug the input and then plug the input back in again, it stops working. So you think, oh, it's a card-based system, I'll just reseat the card. Still doesn't work. You have to depower the rack, which has 14 other cards in it. So be careful. And equipment is now so complicated that things like that really matter. Basically, the test equipment, standard stuff, but monitoring on the codecs and Wireshark is basically the message to take from that. And on the audio-video side, just the usual sort of stuff. We know what's going on. The manufacturers didn't quite as rapidly. A lot of things appear totally counterintuitive. You do something and you think it's going to make it better, and it just makes it totally worse. Work out what was going on. Yeah, it's a lot better now. And just a warning, in the future, control systems are what matters. Lists of various views and opinions from one side to another. Actually, they got to work together. They're just really a set of different cultures, and they're both equally right or wrong. Project management, rules 2 and 3 apply. Best practice, and it's all complicated, particularly on infrastructure projects, because you've got at least 2 sites. I mean, project managers didn't really grasp, some of them didn't really grasp the fact we had 14 sites in Scotland. You do need people to understand networks, IP, packets. Not, oh, I'll busk it. And it does need you to set the requirements out. And requirements really are, what is the managed service? What are the actual deliverables? Now, there's some up there. There's one that isn't mentioned, which is, it is not a good idea for your beloved telco to remove the circuits on Sunday morning during divine service. That probably was the outage that cost us most in terms of apology, investigation, and being nice to people. You can't write a KPI for that. Get that sort of thing sorted out. Those are the requirements. And even if you're sort of doing it for yourself, think managed service. What is the availability? What actually are you wanting it to do? Just see that you've got that, you know, the people there to do it. And is it actually going to work in the way demanded? And can the people afford it? And after all, back to that simplicity thing. Oh yeah, quick, a single circuit. Easy way of getting resilience on a single circuit is to double it up, put some changeovers in. Ah, says the customer, we're buying 2 circuits. Why won't you give us the 2 circuits? Well, okay, you give them the 2 circuits. You can guarantee that's going to fail. Now, I know that there are some people in the room who are very good sound supervisors and the like and would label things well, but most people don't. And so, which circuit is the main and what is the standby? And is it the same every day? And what happens if one of the circuits fails? It will always be the main, and you can bet your bottom dollar they haven't plugged up the standby, and even if they have, they have don't know how to change over to it, etc., etc., etc. That is all, strictly speaking, in the customer's thing. All we're giving them is two circuits. But actually, the managed service on that is absolutely hopeless because nobody quite knows who's responsible for doing what. Actually, if you want to do it, something like that is a good idea. X switches, so that you always get a circuit going through using either of the main paths. But if you're not using one because one's good enough, you can run a spare. In video terms, you can run an isolated camera on that where you've got the main output. You can run an isolated camera down it. If it fails, you lose the isolated camera. You don't lose the main feed. But actually, at the end of the day, is that good enough? The example I gave of the 10 meg circuit, us getting a 1 gig, actually, when you looked at the requirement, you could do it on DSL. So, what are the requirements? What actually is a service level agreement? Can you afford it? And does it have to be resilient? And you do need buy-in from lots of people. And complexity does mean it's got to be checklists. Aha. I got better marks in my Latin O-level than I did in my English language. Not only, but also. Okay, it's just a quick whiz through some features. Quality of service. Get it right. The key thing is that every packet counts, and therefore you don't want the packet to whiz through. I might get lost, which is what gold says. You want them to whiz through and have some space to flex and not be sat upon as they might be in bronze. Quick run through unicast and multicast, which is interesting to think about. Unicast, point to point, selected at the source, coder goes to a decoder. If you want it to go to another decoder, you send up another stream and you send it to that decoder. Multicast is the other way around. It's selected at the decoder. So the coder puts out something into one of these lovely fluffy clouds that you don't quite know all about. The decoder puts in requests to say, please can I join this multicast group? And it connects it. Second decoder comes along, does exactly the same. Now you notice that actually in and out of that first fluffy cow thing, there's only one stream happening rather than two. Now, if you imagine that you have, I don't know, if you want to take the output of local radio stations, let's say, you might have, sort of half a dozen people wanting to listen to your local radio station. Half a dozen streams versus one, worth having. And incidentally, you can plug in another decoder and that will go to the most recent cloud. Okay, you then say, okay, I've now got two coders, isn't it exciting? Let's try and connect to that first decoder, that second decoder. Ah, well, it doesn't like that. Two streams, decoder falls over rapidly. Multicast sort of operation.
Come on.
Extend the thing. Decoder 2 decides that it's going to join a different multicast group. Sets out all the messaging, gets the thing connected. Look that between the last two clouds, that red line has not gone away. And this is because the dear routers can't spend their time talking to each other properly. And that could sew up a conceptual bitrate all the way through. Just a warning which we'll come to later. Incidentally, some units now are actually handling two multicast streams on one into one box, which is a very interesting bit of resilience operation. So we need a control system to deal with the routing that gets rid of the other stream so that the decoder feels happy. You need something that is sort of some feedback on a multicast system so you know that a stream perhaps isn't being used, so you can take the coder out for maintenance. So to route over the IP fabric, you've got the explicit commands to the codec and the implicit network protocols that sort of join it all up. Okay, another jump. In the early days, you saw an awful lot of stuff in the studio that might be audio over Ethernet using a variety of different protocols. It might actually be AS3 over Cat5. Never quite was certain. But out of that, all of that lot, Steve Church at Telos developed LiveWire, which really was quite an interesting technology. But in Europe, we tended to use AS47 or MADI for this sort of operation at the beginning. This consortium has been announced. I'll just touch on the fact that it exists. I think it will be, in a few months' time, probably after IBC, a very, very good topic for you to hear about. Telos have now made LiveWire version something or other Ravenna compliant. It looks like that. I think the key thing that makes it look elegant, to my eyes, is the fact it's got a clock generator in it. It is getting around an awful lot of the clocking issues. With Pete Stevens in the room, we have to be a bit careful here, but basically the major thing that NASIP got sorted out was the fact the codecs actually interoperated. That mattered a great deal because although we selected coders from the same manufacturer, that was not one of our criteria. Our criteria is to get the best value for money for a managed service. So they had to interoperate. And the books are very helpful, particularly 3329. And of course, it spawned an awful lot of other work in the EBU on this and gave us a very good foundation. I just put that in to highlight the fact that Ravenna was a multicast only type operation. ASIP is mainly a UDP operation, and it uses SIP as the basic routing control. I have to mention ISDN because it's good. It costs a lot to do new. When BT couldn't find the ISDN connections in Wells Cathedral, the cost of putting it in was far greater than persuading SysLive to come along with a nice satellite truck and do the broadcast, which is what actually had to do it because BT didn't tell us sort of until about a day before. All of those, what do people use instead of ISDN? They use their phone, I've got Skype there towards the end. You know, there are a number of alternatives. There's not going to be a single solution. And certainly IP over satellite is quite nice in a lot of ways. Anything over satellite has a lovely property that you basically have got this lovely sort of flexible wire that you can wander around with that goes up, you know, via a skyhook, and therefore you don't have had to put in equipment in any particular place. It's got something going for it. All right, for error correction. It's lossy. Therefore, add a few packets so that you can reconstitute. This actually comes from a paper from TLIP, that was presented at NAB. So, in simple terms, embed two packets. One does some check words on an array of seven packets looking downwards, and one does a check word on each packet. All very nice and good, but at some point you need all the packets in an array, so you're adding a latency. And then over the network, you've also got to put two FEC packets through. So you've got adding a lot of packet delay, unless you've got a very high bit rate, like video. And you also are likely to get a slightly hiccupy IP stream coming out, with your content being nicely timed, in our case, let's say 7 milliseconds or something like that, and then the FEC popping in. Now, some IP networks do not like that at all. So you've got to be very careful on your setup. And of course, you're adding more data, which means that if the reason that you were losing data in the first place was it was overflowing, you just make the situation worse. And for contribution use, you don't want the latency, really. So try to use something else. This is a way of doing it. How about replicating? Bandwidth is relatively cheap. Bitrate is relatively cheap. So just replicate over a number of different things. Now, all of those are relatively cheap bits of connectivity. DSL, 10 meg, 3G modem, whatever you've got, almost. And there's a box that does this sort of thing. It uses two or three times the total bit rate, but they need to be perfect. So long as they're not going to drop the same packet all at the same time, it works. And it works in those sorts of things. You're talking about 30-odd packets in 50 days, which is, 545 million packets. That works out at under one packet loss a day, which is quite nice. It fits in this one glitch in 24 hours criteria quite nicely. That's on three. On two, it comes down to, well, it depends which way around you're looking at it, but again, you know, again, probably one glitch a day, something like that, type thing. I quite like, if it really has to be rock steady, using three is quite something is quite good. It gets round the fact that sometimes a DSL line will go down for half an hour at a time, something like that. And it just makes it, you feel a little bit happier. And because really all you're doing is just pumping the same thing out across three paths, it really doesn't add any latency. So it's a win-win sort of situation. So as an STL, you get rid of the main music line circuit. Okay, it's failed, go to ISDN. Okay, well, let's see what happens in a click. Ah, up pops this operation, an encoder. The box is called PIPA. I've got a link to it at the end. And you just put it over the link like that. Ah, well, let's get rid of the ISDN, because if you just add another one, you can act, whether you run over the same circuits here for simplicity, I've added a DSL as well, but you could actually run them over the same circuits. You have got main and reserve, equal quality, and it sort of fails over as soon as that you detect it on the changeover. There's no dial back on ISDN, which has interesting things. A, it takes time, and B, it might be that the phone number it's trying to contact isn't actually there because nobody's bothered to tell you that you've changed the phone number. And, oh yes, if your mending man's there, they can plug their computer in as well. Quite an interesting sort of idea. I mean, that is probably more over-engineered than it needs to be, but the idea of being able to run main and reserve over the same connectivity. Or your lovely regional office. We've probably got rid of the straight phones because people want internet access. So you've brought up two DSL modems, the journos have plugged their computers into it. But you can get rid of the ISDN line, bring it in a PIPA. All right, PIPA and codec. Yes, at the back at the studio end, you've got to go and add a PIPA and a codec. But that gets you... You've added no real connectivity. Well, a bit of connectivity, but it's all cheap. This is almost getting, you know, it's almost costing you nothing to get the connectivity. And, of course, you can still use the same connectivity at the studio end for another site just by bringing up another PIPA and a codec. This all is working using a technology called hitless switching, which basically means that you're taking the first packet that comes. I mean, there is some cunningness in there, obviously. But actually going back from a grotty circuit to a very good circuit, if you've got 200 meg circuits, let's say, you can put the same thing down both legs. And this is quite nice. Looking at that one, WAN path one appears to be shorter, therefore the chances are that it will go absolutely perfectly and every packet will go through WAN path one, except on the rare occasion that something gets lost. Well, it might get lost if you put the rest of the world and their data over that, because that's how the IT systems work. It says, all my IT is going down, WAN path one at the moment, so that actually might delay it, so it might come out of WAN path two, which has only got your content going down it. Aha! I couldn't find an animated JCB, but an animated JCB comes along, takes it out. Do you notice any difference on your hitless switching? No, it just pulls the packets from path two. No problem at all. What's happened with our dear friends in the IT world? Well, they've lost all their connectivity. So they have a bit of a think about it. And the routers chat to each other using weird and wonderful protocols. Chris Harrison will tell me what they are and everything else. So it has to decide that it's going to sort of turn off that path, bring up that path, bring up that path and connect that way, which takes time. My hitless switching has run perfectly through that. And there's a demonstration at IBC of exactly that using video. Now, low bit rate, very long GOP, H.264. You lose a packet and it takes 15 seconds to resync. Not a problem. You just unplug, replug. It just does it. An interesting thought of using what might be for grotty circuits on decent ones. I have to point out resilience models are not simple. I just make reference to the next generation network stuff that Yang Xing and others in the BBC have done. It was a success, but it did highlight a number of areas where more work is done, particularly around control systems. Aha. Uh-huh. It's a lovely book. That is the first sentence of the book, which actually is the founding thing on group analytic psychotherapy. Life is a complex whole, and that's really what we've been talking about. So, why IP? Audio over IP? Well, those are the things. I can't quite cross those out and say, this will come free, or it will allow better quality audio, but it does. And they can be very cheap, they're very different, they need to be handled differently and carefully, but it works, very, very cost effective, But remember, it does have some limitations. But actually, other things have limitations as well. I mean, one comment that I heard was, oh, all those DSLs are going up the same cable. So if the friendly JCB comes along, you lose it. To which I said, well, how's your music line get there? And I then pointed out that actually the DSL is probably carried in a very, very thick multi-pair cable, and the chances are the JCB doesn't go through the whole cable, it just takes the outer core through, while your music line is on a bit of coax, which sort of snags rather rapidly. You need a project checklist. You need to get your people understood and manage the network well. Many things are counterintuitive. Think about service and then the resilience model. A lot of it is being your own telco as well. And the basic planet, get the requirements, get your acceptance criteria sorted out, what are the expectations, and get it documented. And finally, don't forget. Every packet counts. All it needs is just best practice. Not really anything over the top. You just got to be good, but you're that in any case. And it just has lots of interrelationships. Any questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. It's a great talk. Do we have any questions for Peter? I just remember one thing. We were talking about Wells Cathedral and the BT not being able to find ISDN. It did stand for in BT, I sure don't know. That was their acronym for it. Any question for Peter? John?
Peter, the scalability is attractive. Can you see it reaching the stage at which we could actually put each individual microphone with its timestamp up the line so we can mix somewhere where the acoustics are better than the cupboard?
In simple answers, yes. There are issues around ensuring synchronisation of timestamps, but again, well, you might say, well, an MPEG transport stream actually gets around that. One of the nice things about Ravenna is that the idea that you've got an integral timestamp in the stream, and the idea of extending that in through the audio stream. I mean, as you're probably aware, eABTEX has a certain amount of space for, let's call it a serial line connection, a few extra bits in there, which could be used for that and used for synchronisation. And certainly, if you know what you're doing, I mean, just thinking of the TVix product, the video people sort of got themselves hooked on 3D. So you just take two codecs and line them up and just put left eye and right eye down it, and it remains in synchronisation because of a little bit of cunningness. But it's a few bits extra. So if you've got that, and nowadays for television you just assume that you've got a minimum of 16 channels if you want to get them anywhere. It all sort of hangs together quite nicely. So yes, you could do it. And if you wanted to do it now, you could actually use it. You could actually run a video codec with embedded audio in it, and that works quite well. And you can actually turn the video bitrate down so that it actually is less than what the combined 16 or 32 AS3s are doing. And yes, we have actually used it.
Was there any particular reason you keep saying Ravenna? Do you like it more than Dante or any of the others?
Not really.
I didn't see how they could be, because you've got you've got IP. It's a standard. You've got audio.
But the whole issue around getting it working, getting the routing sorted out, etc., etc., etc. I mean, there are these things happening in the studio end. I'm sort of mentioned it because sort of partly for completeness. What I'm mainly looking at is the inter-site connectivity. What happens in the studio centre does get a little bit more sort of interesting, and I have not touched on IP security because that basically comes, there are interesting issues around IP security as well when you begin to get IP connected inside and outside, like taking a voice over IP, replacing your telephone balance units, going straight into a system. There were some interesting issues around that.
By the way, if anybody is interested in the audio networking protocols, next month's lecture is Thoughts from an Audio Networking Agnostic. It's Andy Cooper of Yamaha Europe. Yamaha implements a lot of different networking protocols for different pieces of equipment, so they've got a pretty good idea of what each one does, sort of an unbiased, impartial idea of which what each one does and limitations and benefits of each. So next month, that's that one. That will talk about Ravenna and Dante and all the other ones. So that's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Another question for Peter, maybe.
I shouldn't have silenced them. I think
you've covered it so comprehensively.
Well, another reason for doing this was Media Systems in Siemens used to run sort of lunchtime lectures. Myself, Peter Cowart-Smith, and the two youngsters gave one on audio over IP, and it was an absolute sellout. In fact, sort of half the department couldn't get in the room, and I see a few of them have sneaked in today to get that. It is a topic. I think things are coming. You know, it is something you're going to need to know enough about. You're going to need to persuade these funny people that deal with networks and have an understanding of what's going on. But there are a lot of things happening now that mean that it is cheap, and there are different. It is a different way of doing things. I think that's the thing. And of course, remember those rules, because that's what kept us out of. Well, dug us out of a large amount of trouble all the way through.
Well, thank you very much, Peter.